Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello there.
Hey, we're excited. We're out in Gettysburg today, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and we are at the Eisenhower Hotel. Tim's room number is 314.
Oh, what? Oh.
No, you didn't want me to give that out?
No.
Oh. Well, I thought if people wanted to send you homemade food and elixirs, that's the best way to connect with you.
Now I got to change rooms.
Oh, man. Sorry about that. My fault. But we are out at the Eisenhower Hotel, and maybe it's easier to just call Tim at 612.
Dave, but, no.
What? No? Okay.
Well, no.
Well, how are they
going to
get in touch with you while we're there?
No. Well, now they just call the front desk, I guess, and ask for my room. Yeah. Way to go.
We are out. We're at PhenomCon 2020 and Phenomenology. We'd love for you guys to come on out and visit with us. They do have some tickets still available at the door, walk-ups. It is a great weekend filled with lots of fun and friends, lots of paranormal, and we're going to be talking. Tim and I are there with Darkness Radio. Shane and I are there from the Holzer Files. Members of Ghost Nation and Ghost Hunters are there. There's just a huge plethora of cool guests that'll be on hand. We'd love for you guys to come on out. If you are into the paranormal, there's no reason you shouldn't be there. Phenom2020.com is the website where you can get your tickets and pre-order. If they've already turned that off, just show up to the door and you can buy tickets at the door for the event as well. So make sure you check that out. I think that about covers all that I have to mention right now. Tomorrow, we will have the audio podcast available of A Dark and Stormy Night, our conversation in the supernatural with Stormy Daniels and with Justin Loop. We did the live video on Monday night this week, and thank you for all of you that tuned in and checked that out. For those of you that are used to me doing it on Thursday nights, because we're in Gettysburg, we were unable to do it, but the audio will be available for you, the podcast listener, on Friday. So boom, there you got it. Great opportunity, and it's a lot of fun. They had some weird stories, although I will forewarn people, there are a lot of colorful expletives used throughout, mostly the F-bomb. So be prepared if you are listening and you have children that normally listen with you. This will not be the episode you necessarily want to listen to. Nothing filthy or dirty is talked about, but the F-bomb is used like a frisbee. So feel free to be aware of that going forward. I know a lot of you like to get that heads up in advance, although we'll have an not safe for work, NSFW alert on the episode. We just wanted to make sure you're aware of that right now. But today is a much safer show, Tim.
Or is it?
Yeah, is it? We don't know. We might be conjuring all kinds of demons and creatures from the netherworld. I don't think so, though, because we're here to actually learn. And I was excited. A friend of ours, Michelle Freed, actually, who was my booking agent when I was with Midnight in the Desert. She works with Tim Weisberg. She said, I've got some great guests. Have you ever delved into really the history of seances and the occult? And I said, not recently, and certainly not to any depth. And she said, well, I've got the people you need to speak to. Dan and Kat Eckhart are specialists in this, and they are available. So here we are, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the Darkness on the Edge of Town paranormal podcast, Dan and Kat Eckhart. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
This is fascinating. First of all, I love your ascot. I can't say that enough. More people should look dapper like you. And I'm talking to Dan, not Kat, folks. But that's a cool look, man. Tim and I popped up on the website and we looked, and I go, look, you got to like a guy who's a class act, who's wearing an ascot and knows about the occult. And this, you're the guy I want to go to learn this stuff. Not guys like me sitting here in my Mr. Spock t-shirt that says, trek yourself before you wreck yourself. That's not the guy you want to trust with this information. So we appreciate this. Seances, communication with the dead. Listen, we are in an era that seems to rival, if not be far more superior to people's interest in spirituality than any other time in history. Am I wrong on that, guys? Or do you feel that we've kind of surpassed any other past era of interest in this?
It feels like we are living in a new golden age. The pop culture element of the occult is really at a fever pitch with shows like Sabrina and movies, revisiting movies like The Craft and all of the Conjuring films, of course, a new one coming out very shortly. People are really interested in this material. And maybe for the first time, there's been a little bit of a divorce between this material and the fear around it. People are more willing to engage with it on its own terms, as opposed to plugging it into a larger, maybe religious narrative or fear of what could possibly be out there, the demons, the ghouls.
Well, is there, you know, obviously, as we look through time and history, it seems spirituality rises in times of turmoil and tumult, right? When there's wartime, people want to communicate with those that they lost. Civil War era, obviously, World War One, World War Two, things like that. You know, we've often talked about the fact there was this kind of reawakening after 9/11 that took place in our country and has never really died down. But the concept of communicating with the dead is as old as time, right? And different, every religion, every belief system, every culture seems to have some iteration of finding ways to divine conversations with the dead.
Absolutely. There's a huge quest for something beyond ourselves. And as you stated, communication with spirit goes back as long as we have records. People are attempting to pierce what happens on the other side of death. What messages do spirits have for us? What can they show us about our lived experience? Pinning that to the seance is a little difficult because the idea of the seance as we imagine it, I always like to say it's kind of like looking at when did rock and roll start? Everyone has a different opinion of when did rock and roll start? The seance is a little bit like that. There's elements of it going back through antiquity. But then there's this moment where what we imagine today to be a great seance, just like we imagine a great rock and roll band, it happens in a certain window of time and it comes into fruition in a space that is economically uncertain, socially uncertain, and also a moment where people are beginning to explore what can we do beyond just the kind of things we've been passed on? How can we push this and develop this?
Well, we're going to reach now through the veil of time and space to try to make communication with Kat. Kat, if you're there, give us a sign of your presence.
I'm here. Can you hear?
Hey, you are. That's great. Kat, I want to know from your perspective on this as well. Looking at the concept of spirit communication and trying to tie us to that other realm or bring that realm closer to us, has it always been a stigmatized type of performance? Or you know, I mean, obviously we see in the early 1920s and 30s through the 40s that there was quite a bit going on, even at the beginning, you know, turn of the century, there was a lot going on with this. But was it looked down upon by society or was it accepted?
Well, that's a complicated kind of answer, I think. I think there were different groups that had different feelings on spirit communication. When you're talking around the late 1800s and into the 1920s and beyond, there were certain religious groups that didn't like what was happening, didn't like that it wasn't taking place within the church even, and didn't think that it was part of what they considered to be an appropriate view of eschatology, what happens after you die. But the spiritualists, they kind of had that eschatology that was kind of like a more democratic, more available to people. Mediums could be anyone, really. Mediums were often women. And this was a different thing than the church.
Yeah, this is a social reflex in many ways. We have this moment where, as Kat said, women are kind of spearheading a religious movement. And to be clear, there had been women in positions of spiritual import before the spiritualist movement and the seance movement. But this was the first time that it could literally be like anyone. These are very workaday kind of individuals who are grasping at things that relate directly to their present condition and circumstance. So maybe where someone was going to a weekly church service did not necessarily feel like that was speaking to their immediate priority and needs. There was this other thing, which was the seance, where spirits came through in a visible, felt way, and then had messages that weren't exclusively about like what we imagine seances to be about today, where it's like, oh, well, it's, you know, a dead loved one coming through, or it's a grandparent or something. That happened, to be clear. But also the spirits had like messages about what was happening around the people of the time. So there's like an active message about, at the time, women's suffrage, the abolitionist movement, very like workaday kind of politics around like railways and banks. Like there's conversations that I think a lot of people would feel are very resonant today. Maybe things haven't changed so much, where the spirit world was offering feedback about people's lived lives. And that was lightning in a bottle in many ways.
Now, communication, obviously there have been mediums and soothsayers, people that claim to be able to speak to the dead. And there's even mention of them in the Bible, right? There, mm-hmm. there were many that could do this and have this gift or this ability. When do we start to see kind of the table and the, you know, or the group sessions start to take place? Because this always felt like it was a very intimate situation, right? It was always, you know, one or two family members, and then all of a sudden it started to become kind of a larger deal. Do you see any specific genesis? And I know you said it's hard to pinpoint where this really kind of blew up like rock and roll, but where do we start to see this become more popular?
So we begin to see this at the late 1850s. We have the Fox sisters, of course, in the burned over district of New York, who, for those of you who aren't aware, like the founding members of what would become spiritualism, what would become the seance movement as we imagine it. And they established a really easy form of communication, which was just a binary table, like a rapping sound, a clicking noise. Mm-hmm. It wasn't super developed. Over time, it develops rapidly. But in the beginning, it's important to note, these are just little clicks and knocks. These are sounds coming from somewhere else. If that sounds familiar, we can point towards poltergeist phenomena or even Bigfoot, like wood knocking sounds. There's that element of spirit connecting through rapping noise in a binary fashion. Mm-hmm. Then we begin to move into that kind of darkened space, moving in through the end of the Civil War, of course, one of the most traumatic instances of warfare in the United States. And lots of people don't come home from this, obviously. And there are brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers who are grieving the loss of their sons, their husbands, their fathers, who go to these spaces where they can hope to make contact and pierce this veil of connection. So that's where we begin to really see this building out into in the late 19th century into the early 20th, of sitting around a table in a darkened room and having some kind of connection. Sometimes this is physical, as Kat can attest to, and sometimes this is purely mental messages which are being received.
Right.
But that idea of like the Victorian seance, the spiritist seance, the Scooby-Doo-like kind of vision we all have comes really from that late period of the 1800s into the early 1900s. Over time, though, they begin to develop, and sitting around a table doesn't become something that's necessary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You have it kind of branch out into different forms, just standing or even being in sort of big conference spaces or in what you'd traditionally view as church spaces. Mm-hmm. And before we move on, I do want to mention that around the time with the Fox sisters, because of them, spiritualism kind of took a turn away from the occult. A little bit before that, it was more of like a hidden practice, so more of a associated with the occult, with witchcraft, not as we would see it today, but back then. When the Fox sisters kind of brought that into popular consciousness and started traveling around talking to spirits in these really unique and entertaining ways, it really opened it up to communities starting to try this on their own.
Exactly. There's a real, we can't stress how much of a pop culture thing this is.
Right.
To the point where, you know, there's a seance. It always surprises people when you say there was a seance in the White House. Abraham Lincoln and, of course, his wife, Mary Todd, attended a seance in which it was rumored, and there's no real factual corroboration of this. Mitch Horowitz writes about it in his excellent book, Occult America, which I highly recommend if any of your listeners haven't read it, where allegedly Abraham Lincoln asks for advice on how to win the war to the spirit world. Now, it's likely this was tongue in cheek and he wasn't seriously seeking advice from the spirit world on this. But it does point to how popular these things were. And Kat's right. They were plugged into the wall of Christianity and average kind of church going folk of the time in such a way that it made it palatable. It made it accessible in a way that, you know, witchcraft or conjure or folk work maybe wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The concept of a cult, I mean, people immediately hear a cult and they think dark, right? Mm-hmm. And black magic and that kind of history associated with it. Can you give us a little bit of a wider concept of what it means when you mention the occult?
Right. It's a big term. It technically means hidden things, the things that you don't know as well, the topics, especially related to magic, that are not easily accessible or not easily understood. And there's a reason for that.
Yes, the occult is a catch-all term and became a catch-all term for things which were outside of the norm. They were heterodox, like heterodox Christianity, Gnosticism, spiritualism, spiritism. Any of these things could be considered occult practices. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is the people who are involved in occult practices, especially historically, would have been quiet about it, but maybe not necessarily viewed themselves as being outside of the realm of the standard practice of the time. So, for example, spiritualism historically didn't see itself as distinct from Christianity. It saw itself as a Christian sect, much in the way that many denominations of Christianity exist. However, there's, you know, argument as to whether or not that is an actual part of the orthodoxy. And I think you could make an argument that it's not. Mm-hmm. So the occult kind of takes on the trappings of whatever it needs to be. It becomes more visible thanks to people like Crowley, thanks to people like Spare or Jack Parsons, this concept of like the occultist in the Egyptian robes, kind of seeking divine inspiration from past gods and deities.
I think that's what most people think about when they think the occult.
Mm-hmm.
Is Crowley and the OTO.
Right.
Like that.
Right. But it's important to stress that not everyone who's an occultist is a Thelemite or involved in Satanism of some stripe or another. The occult can simply be like Christian witches. The term exposes the problem with using language in the paranormal, which is essentially that there are deep limitations to our linguistic structures. I'm sure you've experienced this on the Holzer Files or when you're investigating paranormal places. People lack the terminology to clearly articulate what they mean.
And that's a great point to this aspect, right? But, you know, I think because the term cult and occult are so close and everybody, you know, starts to kind of picture the same little dark machinations, mm-hmm. that's just their association instead of realizing, like you said, it's more hidden. It's something that just isn't as prevalent in, you know, maybe the regular lexicon of society. Now, communication with the spirit realm seems to have grown. And in some cases, I wonder if it was meant as an entertainment field that outgrew itself. Is it the evolution of an entertainment field? Because you've got people that, and the reason I bring this up, we have friends that do this wonderful illusion show out of Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And they do this amazing, it's a Victorian era illusion and stage show with a talented medium, Juliana Fay. They tell you this is all for entertainment. This is all an illusion and a stage act. But yet afterwards, people come to her because they believe she truly has the gift, and it becomes it's an interesting element, right? You become more than the creation that you've created.
Isn't that amazing? That's like one of my favorite things about the history of this. And Kat, maybe you can speak to this. I don't want to dominate the conversation, but I love that element of the co-creation of the paranormal and the way in which it's kind of like what Hansen writes about with the trickster and the paranormal, this inseparable connection between entertainment and illusion and real phenomena and that performative nature of both seance or ritual.
Mm-hmm. And magic.
If we look at like occult practice, like say something Crowley would do, he would dress in robes and chant and carry on and raise energy and then hopefully channel the moon child or something. What he's doing is a performance, and Crowley ticketed some of his performative rituals. It doesn't necessarily mean that Crowley was not tapping into magic or performing magic. It simply meant that he was, engaging in this performative ritual environment. Kind of like
anybody can be a pianist, but Liberace came out with the candelabra and flowing garments and sparkles and furs, right? I mean, it's the spectacle of the show does not detract from the fact that what he's still doing is real.
Exactly. And historically, there is conversation around this. We look back today and we think, thanks to Houdini and people like him of the time, that these were seances, mediums are all like these people who are preying on the grieving and this like almost grief vampirism. And it was top to bottom fraud. The public at the time was far more savvy. They understood that some of these elements were performative. They understood the difference between like a Keller stage show of a seance and a spiritualist church. And they understood that there was an entertainment value implicit within them. However, of course, we do, whenever we discuss seance or mediumship, we do need to discuss fraud because it is a component of some of this this history and some of this work. It's a fraud is very real. And I think to say that it's not right is disingenuous. However,
isn't it hard, though, to denote what is fraud and what's reality? If you become a believer in your own hype, mm-hmm. and people tell you enough times, no, you're really gifted, right? I mean, even Sir Arthur Conan Doyle believed that Houdini's presence and his ability to do illusions was something far more than just sleight of hand, that he truly had magic in him. If you have enough people tell you that and start to believe in you, it seems to me that you create your Manson, you create your David Koresh, because you tell somebody enough times they're God to you and that they have these abilities. Do they start to buy into it? And where does the line, that delineation between fraud and reality, start to get blurred?
Exactly. This is this transcends both this conversation around mediumship, but it transcends the conversation around our current lived experience. We receive inputs from whether it be television or movies or what have you, which informs the way we view ourselves. It informs the way we view Dave or Dan or Kat. What people say about us creates this. And to some extent, Doyle's not wrong. Houdini does become a god amongst men. Houdini, we remember his name and we remember few of his contemporaries. He did have some kind of X magic factor, not in the way that Doyle thought, not in the way of communication, mm-hmm. but certainly in the way of presenting himself and creating his future.
Mm-hmm. But there's that question there of who built Houdini.
Exactly.
Was it Houdini himself or those people around him, as you said, Conan Doyle, who said he was this amazing creature?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right. Well, you've got that certain element that's it's almost indiscernible, right? Because, mm-hmm. Tim, I don't know where Tim's going to land on this one, but to me, it's like Kanye West. I don't understand the popularity of this guy or the belief that he is this talented, gifted musician. I don't get it. To me, it's complete smoke and mirrors, but people, anything this guy slaps his name on turns to gold.
And and that's Houdini's story in many ways. It's crucial to point out that a lot of the debunking work Houdini did was smoke and mirrors. In a famous example, he went to Lilydale to try and for those of you unfamiliar, Lilydale was a spiritualist camp where a lot of mediums lived, who were doing a lot of readings. It still exists today. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting to go and see the space, both for historical context, but also to know what the spiritualist movement is up to today. But Houdini went there to find their best mediums and was tossed out. Charitably, you could say, well, he was tossed out because he was too close to the fraud. Or less so, you could say people who were involved with the honest practice of mediumship and attempting to reach beyond this realm didn't have time for the showman antics of Houdini. They didn't have time for being plastered in the newspapers about how he thought they worked. That element of building oneself's legacy is an interesting component to his life, but also one that I think reflects really strongly on the type of work we do today, which is why when Kat and I work in seances, we want to be very clear that what we're attempting to do, and when we discuss seance, is moving the conversation away from an element of fraud or an element of proof. I think evidential mediumship ends up in this problem today. If we talk about that later, that's great. But moving it from proving beyond a shadow of a doubt to creating liminal space, creating space where something strange can happen, and then we can internalize and work through that. Because ultimately, mediumship and spirit communication is about actualization of the person, not so much proof of like the Edison telephone of calling up spirits from beyond.
Oh my goodness. that's a big claim and not
it's
where
a big
I thought
claim.
You were going.
Yeah. I know.
Well,
Go in 1 second, but I'm just curious, right? Yeah. When you're reaching through this attempting, and you said the key word, I think, is attempting, right? There's no guarantee of what's going to happen. I participated for an upcoming special that'll air later this season. I participated in a seance in a very unique location, and there were four of us. I was skeptical going in. I'm like, I've worked with my friend Chris Fleming before. I've seen him do spiritual and gallery readings. But to actually be a part of something, I wasn't sure how this was going to go. And I had such a bizarre experience that I can't even begin to convey the nature of how weird things got. Mm-hmm. And you look at this, and again, is it the mind and desire wanting to have something happen that projects, or is it all in concert with one another? Is there a spiritual element to it that our own imaginations and mind need to help create the template for this phenomena to begin to exist?
Yeah, I think that was well said. I think your latter point is how it ultimately works. It is in concert with each other, because we know that beliefs help shape our reality. And what we expect to see is what we're most likely to see. So when we're talking about seances and experiencing the paranormal and being able to even see or experience that, I mean, that's based on the human mind and how it works. And it's also based on, I guess, if you can say reality as something that's divorced from just our own perception of it. But you're absolutely right. Like, our beliefs going into these experiences, these seances, are really, really important in shaping what occurs and how we understand what's happening.
Exactly. You mentioned this element of the things that happened were very bizarre. Mm-hmm. And Kat and I often like to point out in this work that, especially for mediumship, rather than jumping to like, what does this mean for my life, or what are the exact implications of this message, or what's happening around me, moving away from interpretation and simply cataloging, trying to be the observer of the strange, and living with that tension of, did I imagine this, or did this really happen? And that's something that Kat and I have espoused frequently in our own work, is we are skeptics in the grand term of skepticism, which is a historical desire to question everything.
The preservation of doubt.
Exactly. So there are times where things happen amongst us and we say, did you see that? I can't believe that happened. And then, no, it could have just been a trick of the light. It could have just been we got lucky. It could have just been that this person was, you know, hallucinating, what have you. Because to fall into the category of everything is spirit communication or everything is as it appears leaves one open to, you know, nefarious actors. And to fall into the category of everything is bunk leaves us closed to this liminal space of creation.
And it begs the question, right? Because we can, like Houdini, because we can recreate a scenario and find a way to fake it, does that mean that the actual experience itself was fake to begin with?
Exactly.
Right?
Dr. Jack Hunter has a really great example of this in one of his most recent books on physical mediumship. Mm-hmm. Kat, you know all about this.
I know some about it, but I'm not sure.
Give us real quick a definition of the term physical mediumship so that people understand the difference in these varieties we're discussing.
Of course. So people generally think of two different groups of mediums, either mental mediums or physical mediums. Mental mediums are said to receive messages just telepathically, something that they hear in their head. Whereas physical mediums express spirit contact in the material world, either through like manipulation of vibrations or energies or something like that. So that's where you get into ideas like wrapping, spirit wrapping, ectoplasm, table tipping, physical manifestations.
Okay. And now I've seen different elements of these in live settings. And again, being a skeptical believer myself, I'm always looking for the strings and the mirrors, right?
Yes.
Some I cannot even... I just can't wrap my head around what I experienced.
Exactly.
And that's fine.
We don't have to give it a firm definition. We don't have to put it into some box of meaning. Sometimes it's good to just sit with these things.
Sometimes even we've found different manifestations or things that happen in our seances have different meanings to the various sitters.
Exactly.
Which is really interesting because, you know, humans are meaning-making machines. So, of course, we're going to filter everything that happens in our own experience, in our own perception. So I think that it can be helpful just to sit back and observe. And as Dan was talking about Dr. Jack Hunter before, he's kind of advocating for an anthropological view of the paranormal, an anthropological study of the paranormal, where you don't put all of your sort of paradigm about how the world works onto what you're observing. It's kind of just taking it all in and documenting it as best you can. And I think we can do that when we're investigating the paranormal or we're sitting for a seance.
Or we're looking towards its history. Mm-hmm. For example, this concept of apports, of items being physically manifested by spirit into a seance space, was something that Kat and I really struggled with that concept of, because it seems so obviously trickery. It seems so obviously like, oh, you're going to tell me you were in a dark room and then all of a sudden rose petals appeared on the table. Like the aggressive reading of that is, well, this is fraud. The occult reading of that would be maybe more metaphorical. And I think that can trip people up. A lot of occult history, a lot of occult books are written in a metaphorical language. So this idea of roses appearing in the seance room could allude to roses as the Rosicrucians or the wounds of Christ, this kind of religious imagery. Mm-hmm. So there are charitable and uncharitable ways to read this. But at the end of the day, Kat and I still sit and think like, we've had weird experiences where bizarre things have happened that impacted the physical realm that, frankly, even though we're seance hosts, we don't know what to do with that. It just speaks to a larger, weirder world.
Yeah.
So like apportation, where things are suddenly appearing, right? There's
exactly
this footage of the sky raining down rose petals.
Exactly.
There is the ectoplasmic emanations from physical mediums, these cheesecloth-like substances seen out of their mouth. But it's weird how, you know, is it the spirit realm stepping up their game because people are questioning XYZ? So now we have to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt again that more is occurring than is seen with the naked eye. So let's create ectoplasm, and then let's create lights, and then let's create things apporting.
Exactly. And ultimately, this is why Lilydale bans physical mediumship, why they don't offer it on their premises following the these kinds of seance busts and medium busts of the 20s and 30s. It was if these things were happening, are they also happening 7 days a week, multiple times per day? Likely not. And that puts pressure on mediums. It puts pressure on the paranormal investigators to kind of create hype. We see that today, where, you know, individuals are busted on YouTube or in blogs about, well, that was faked for this reason. Well, it's the nature of the way we consume this material. And so there was a very definitive move from physical mediumship to mental mediumship and evidential mediumship, so much so that today physical mediumship is mostly synonymous with this idea of Scooby-Doo and yanking off the mask of the ghost at the very end. Today, there's almost an overabundance of evidential mediumship and this people feeling as though maybe they're not real mediums if spirits aren't giving them names and dates and tombstones, although that may still happen.
But the concept of these seances being a way to communicate with the other side, and hoping that you're going to make this. I know that you guys are advocates for the seance, but with the amount of claims that are made, the amount of people out there that do things like this, how much of it do you believe is wishful thinking response for people that are just dealing with the grief process? And how much of it do you believe is true spiritual communication? And how do we divide between the two?
Mm-hmm. I think it will be difficult to really know what is true spirit communication and what is simply, you know, strings, mirrors. Because that part of the world is occult. It is hidden in that way. But I think it's kind of our job to explore that. And I think that's the fun, one of the most fun parts of doing this is exploring it, not only what we do and creating the seance, but, you know, going to other seances and experiencing other ways of doing mediumship or spirit contact, because there are so many different ways of doing it.
Yeah, and that so many different ways of doing it is, I think, ultimately the answer to how do we divine whether this is happening in the material world or happening in our brain. And that, I think, is the democratization of the seance. It is equipping people to say, this, you can create your own ritual space in your basement, in your living room. You can just go and do. And then what comes through comes through. When there was this height of seance activity, it was not simply just mediums sitting around a circle and offering nights of seances, which did happen. But there was also people playing with spirit boards in their living room with their, you know, aunts or with their girlfriend or what have you. We speak very frequently with individuals who, you know, their grandparents would take them downstairs as children and they would sit around and do like hymn sings and try and contact the spirit world. For us,
things like bibliomancy as well.
Exactly. These concepts of divination through the spirit world by using physical objects like books or pendulums. Doing that and putting those tools in the hands of the guests is ultimately, I think, the way the guests can then discern for themselves what is valuable and what isn't.
Right.
Especially because there's a plethora of tools like automatic writing or scrying or pendulums or channeling. Putting people and giving them like a scrying mirror and saying, this too is mediumship. Your channeled art is mediumship.
Yes.
Dance can be mediumship. Then gives them the direct one-to-one connection with the spirit world. And it takes the onus off of some individual orchestrating. Although you do need someone to, you know, show you the ropes or at least provide the space.
All right. Now that I respect, I love the openness, but the concept of it's really up to the individual to choose what makes sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But that's where it leads openings for fraud in such high levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more with the Eckharts, Dan and Kate, or Kat. We have a link up for their website, theeckharts.com. It's on today's program guide. You get all that information and more. We'll discuss more about communication with the other side. And why I believe the seance is one of the most powerful ways to connect with the beyond. How is that? What should we be looking for? And what are our expectations? We'll discuss that and more when we return. You're listening to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. Thank you for spending some time with us here today, and we hope you're enjoying the show as much as we are enjoy bringing it to you. Remember, take these favorite episodes, share them with your social media, friends, family, email links. Let them know about the show. If you have friends that maybe haven't been turned on to Darkness Radio, this is a great way to do it. There's links in every one of the episodes so that you can find ways to share them with your social media. We'd appreciate that. Just as our gift to you is the show, your gift back to us would be in sharing it. So thank you for doing that. Our guests today, Dan and Kat Eckhart, we're talking about the kind of the science and history of seances and the occult. Let's talk about why. Why is it that you believe the seance is one of the most powerful ways to connect with the beyond? And then do you have a definition for what the beyond is and what it entails?
Those are great questions. I'll start with...
I knew I'd get to a couple of great questions.
Yes, yes. No, I mean, your other questions before were also great.
Just teasing. Thank you.
The seance, as Dan and I do it, and I think as people have done it in history, is a ritual. It's a time set aside for gathering together with a specific intention to engage in the beyond, to engage with spirits. And I think that this is important in making it a powerful ritual. It's important in making the spirit contact successful, because you have that intention and expectation, usually, along with the belief that something is going to happen, that I think opens the doors for something to happen. And I don't know, the beyond?
The beyond is complicated because spirits seem to give us different answers for different spirits. There's an element of, you know, there's always discussion around near-death experiences and people who are Christians seeing Jesus, or people who are Muslims seeing like a Muhammad. And these are not, they're not limited to near-death experiences. When we have a Catholic spirit on the line in a seance, they talk about like experiencing, you know, some what we would consider to be standard like Catholic or Catholicism ideas. So there does seem to be an element of creating our own like conscious experience of the universe. Mm-hmm. I think there was an element, and historically there was an attempt to kind of create an eschatology around spiritualism and spiritism through Summerland, or this kind of secularized heaven that where life is beautiful all the time kind of a world. Mm-hmm. And that didn't really catch on. It was written about and certain people believed it and held to it, but it didn't change society or change our connection with the paranormal in the same way that mediumship and seances, the act of going to them, did. So when we talk about what happens after death, Kat and I still don't know. It seems
we
like
have theories.
We have theories, though. And it seems like spirit does retain some of its consciousness.
Yeah. Personality.
Personality. Through. But not... not all of that said consciousness or personality.
Well, yeah, and we also think that there's strong evidence out there for reincarnation, mm-hmm. for ideas like past lives. There's a lot of past life research that's really interesting. But what when you were talking about near-death experiences, it made me think about near-death research where people kind of experience had very similar experiences, usually, like this concept of love and seeing past family members. But I believe the research said that it did kind of filter through different people's beliefs.
Exactly.
Like whether or not they saw Jesus
exactly.
or someone like that.
So we'll see that where a spirit may come through and have predominantly like come from a very strong religious background. And the message that they may provide is like, this provided a lot of meaning for me. And this still provides meaning for me, implying some kind of continuation. Mm-hmm. But then also an acceptance of the person who is there, of their current trajectory, kind of an understanding of trajectory, if you will, an understanding of the lived experience as reference or lens for the reality around us.
Mm-hmm. Do you think then in communicating, because people are going into mediumship reading or a gallery or a seance, if they're showing a willingness to be open, but do you see people that come in that maybe are more reticent to believe are still having experiences that are shifting and changing their beliefs?
Yes, all the time.
Yes, usually the husbands.
Usually the husbands. They're dragged along by their wives and they say, this is all BS. And then by the end, they're saying, what is this? yes. What's most interesting is, and I think you bring up something that's tangential to like myths around seance. Some of the myths around seance and mediumship is that everyone who goes is deranged in grief and just hoping for some connection with the other side, that there is just an upswelling of inconsolable grief mm-hmm. and confusion and just a need for life after death. Kat and I, we see that extremely rarely. Most people who come through are simply coming to watch, to say, what is this? Is there something more here? Mm-hmm. They have questions about workaday issues, like, will I have the house in 6 months? Should I make that job move? They're asking questions like that from the spirit world. And some of them want to connect with loved ones, but generally it's a connection of, I feel like my mom's in my house. I feel her spirit. Is she there? That's really the, it's more of an intent to experience.
Yeah, and that is historically how people approach seances. And we can't speak for, you know, every seance host out there. We can only speak for what people come to us for. But mm-hmm. they do. They have all sorts of different beliefs. And there isn't one way to approach seance or to go to a seance.
Exactly.
In communicating how, you know, if people are out there looking to find a way and they want to do a seance, they want to find somebody, how do you even go about finding somebody that's genuine or has a true gift? Mm-hmm. You know, again, I guess that's all subjective, but, you know, what should people be looking for?
Yeah, I think the answer is a bit mundane. Mm-hmm. The answer is... look at their website. Make sure they're not saying, I am the only way with through you can do this. Make sure that they are, you know, coming off as generous and open-minded and they have good reviews. Simple things like that.
Yes. It's relatively easy to tell the difference between, you know, a performative seance of magic and mystery versus a earnest or erstwhile attempt to communicate with the beyond. Just by looking at marketing. But then one of the things Kat and I really stress is, does this individual empower mm-hmm. other people? Does the individual equip the guests with the tools that they would need to communicate with the beyond outside of the seance room with that individual?
Right.
Always be very wary, whether it's political leaders or people holding seances or churches or what have you, of the individual who says, I have the special relationship with the beyond, with God, with destiny, and only I can free you. Because that obviously leads very closely to people with cult-like tendencies or with fraud. If the person is encouraging you and equipping you, then that's generally a good indication that they are as earnest about their work as you are.
All right. I appreciate that. Then the spirits themselves, you know, obviously we're always looking for evidential proof, you know, by giving us information that nobody should know but that spirit. Mm-hmm. And that's always been a big element to this. With the advent of social media and how we put our stories out there, you know, I've got to guess it's harder and harder to feel secure in the information that you're getting, that it wasn't something gleaned from social media or from a presence.
Yeah, there's a lot of conversation around that. I think Netflix had a recent documentary
series
where
Surviving Death,
where they actually discussed a lot about how certain psychics, mediums, even like tent revival style pastors have used Facebook to gain information. And we put a lot of information out there.
We do.
Historically, though, it's interesting to note that the information that we put out there may be more volume of it. Mm-hmm. And there certainly may be more channels by which to receive it. But if we look at the historical, like, kind of environment around mediumship, say the middle 1800s to 1930, where people didn't really move and lived in their whole town their entire life, it was very easy to also find information by going to a local graveyard or talking with someone at a bar, because everybody knew everybody. And so the information there, our quantity of information may have changed, but finding quality and finding things that resonate deeply with you, that is maybe just as difficult as it always has been. I would think that individuals who have a deep, profound connection with a spirit, where a spirit tells them something, and not just tells them, I was born on this date and I died of this, but tells them, I remember you in this childhood moment, that is profoundly different than getting some kind of fact and figure. And that's why Kat and I kind of push back against this trend in evidential mediumship, where everything is about the date, because sometimes the things spirits have to tell us aren't verifiable. And that's true for you and I, it's true for anyone. We all have our diaries, our secret thoughts, our things we wouldn't share with anyone else. And how could we possibly know something that maybe was very real to grandma that she never disclosed? We all have family secrets, right?
Right. Well, that's why it's so important.
Speak for yourself. I have no family secrets.
Dave's an open book, but
he's the exception.
Yes. That's
right.
But speaking like to how we do mediumship, that's why we kind of just say whatever mm-hmm. is coming to us. Like, we're not going to put our interpretation on it. And then the person receiving that message is going to understand what's important there.
Yes, it's that very much an element again of catalog. We don't, Kat and I don't always know. Yeah. Spirits don't always come and say, this is why I'm telling you this.
Right.
And we, you know, we accept that mediums may secret here. Aren't always right.
What?
Yeah.
About everything.
Believe it or not, what's interesting is in the research around mediumship, Kat, you should speak to this. There's compelling research around mediumship and mediums' abilities to accurately diagnose from looking at an image as to whether or not a person is still with us. But Kat.
I hate that study.
I know. Share it. It's great.
Come on.
You're leading with the study I don't like. It's the one where the mediums did worse than the other participants that did not claim to be mediums.
Exactly. So mediums were better at identifying on a photo whether or not the person had passed.
Better than chance.
Better than chance. But they scored worse than non-mediums in mm-hmm. identifying how the individual died. Both groups scored better than chance, the non-mediums and the mediums.
Which is interesting.
So again, there's that wonderful element of like the trickster and the paranormal, of not being able to pin down something which we would hope to have abundant materialist evidence for. And yet both scored better than chance, which speaks to some spirit communication or interaction.
So
which
yeah,
might be that might actually hold the element of the real insight to mediumship and communication with the other side. Because if you look at the fact that I go in believing I'm insensitive, but I'm able to pick up on this, I had no expectations. I had nothing holding me back because I didn't, I had no belief that this was going to happen anyway. So that gives you the, maybe that removes that wall, that barrier of id and ego of, am I really reading this? Am I looking at the psychology of the moment?
Dave, you would be an excellent occultist.
What do you mean I would be? As far as you know, I'm an excellent occultist because I am one. I got to learn more. I 15 years in this, I'm always interested in the concept, you know, concepts of how this all breaks down. And, you know, when people tell us, oh, we're all capable of being a medium. Well, we're all capable of being a murderer, right? It's in how you use it. And I think that that's why we've been successful in TV shows like The Holzer Files. I'm not a medium to the extent that people expect, but I go in, I set my intention, I open myself up, and I get communication through divination devices that, you know, I think bonding with my tools, working with the same set of tools creates this conduit, creates this complete circuit that makes spirituality a little bit easier to come through, which maybe would help people understand it a little bit more. Maybe you're afraid of that concept of being a medium or having those abilities because, A, you might be brought up in the belief system of religion that that's wrong, right? And by giving it to, you know, the divination tool. I've talked to tarot readers and bones readers and tea leaf readers. And I said, do you really need that? Or are you using that as a crutch? And most have admitted to me, I use it as a crutch. Oh, I'm getting the information psychically, but I'm presupposing it on the card. So if I'm wrong, it's the card's fault, right?
Exactly. That's beautiful. And that is very much what we experience in our work is equipping someone. So many people come and have questions about spirit or have interactions that they are afraid to claim as spirit connection because they don't want to look silly. Sometimes they don't want to be sinful. And sometimes they just don't want to look like a crazy person. And so they say, I've never had a spirit come to me. But then they immediately start talking about how their mother passed away and a bird showed up. It was her favorite bird and it lived on the windowsill for 2 weeks until all the funeral preparations and all the burial stuff was done and the estate was settled. And then the bird flew away and they never saw it again. And that person is actually maybe very much tapping into a real element of communication. But there's a hesitancy to claim it. There's an intuitive knowledge, but a hesitancy to say, okay, I can believe that. I can accept that.
Yeah. And the stigma around modern mediumship is no joke. Dan and I had to handle that in ourselves before we decided to do this, like as a career.
Right.
What do you mean by that? Please elaborate.
Well, I mean, we both were brought up in the Christian tradition, in different Christian traditions. And so we kind of had to overcome our own internal beliefs about, is this wrong? This might be wrong. it could be just complete bunk. Perhaps we are hallucinating or have delusions of grandeur. Like, who am I to claim this title?
Yeah.
To claim this cool, quote unquote, ability or power. And so there was a lot to work through there. And
exactly.
A lot we had to do, a lot of internal work before we could do it properly, really.
Right. And do it in a way that was hopefully helpful for people who wanted to experience something like this. Because the conversations you bring up, even in this interview, are things which have weighed heavily on our path, and I'm sure many other people in alternative spirituality, psychic circles, mediums, etc., who deal with this element of being told by television, by culture, by their family, that you're bad for doing this, and you're at the very worst deluding yourself, but at the very best deluding yourself, and at the very worst harming others. Mm. And when you do this work, I wonder if Cindy could speak to this too. When you do this work, there is a sense of the transformative nature of it and the empowerment of it and the healing of it, not just for groups of people joining, but for everyone involved in the seance. This moment, this encounter with liminal, with the beyond, with, oh my gosh, there's something out there besides me, that really, really challenges the person and really challenges the even the hosts to overcome these feelings of, you know, who am I? Right. It asks us
like almost inadequacy, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
It's funny because I've known mediums and spiritualists as well that have told me that there have been times when their ego starts to get in the way and suddenly they cannot connect at all. It isn't until the humbling moment of being reduced back to this is more than just you. There's something greater at play and once they realign and accept that aspect of it, suddenly their gifts appear to return. I heard a laugh. Is this touching a nerve, Dan?
Oh, it definitely feels very real. You know, the joke is like once you say that you're like good at manifesting, then all of a sudden you're impoverished, right? Like every occultist like of note, people say, well, if Aleister Crowley was so good at magic, why did he die in poverty? You know, these kinds of elements. And I think there is something about the ego there. There's something that's, oh man, like, one, there's a desire to claim it and to say, yes, this is something that we're doing. And then also that element of once you say it, oh no, if I do believe it too strongly, will it disappear? Will it go away? Is this the night where I'm going to lead a group of people in hoping to contact the other side? And we sit in the dark for 2 hours and nothing happens and everyone hates me. This is a real, you know, feeling that I think a lot of people engage with. Maybe you felt it.
You sound like you need a hug, Dan. Come here.
No. It's just that I think it's an important thing for people to engage with.
And that's what we have to do as mediumship, as mediums, to speak to your point. We kind of have to give space to that ego. Otherwise, it will block us up. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the messages we're receiving are our internal selves screaming, you need to hear this. You need to confront this for some reason.
That's an interesting element to it as well, right? Because you should have a certain level of ego to feel secure that you are doing what you do. And I, you know, we've got friends in the field who I think are, you know, they're kind of funny to me because they're like, I'm not answering to that. I know it because I know it. And that's the extent of it. And in one side, you're like, yeah, damn it, you're right. And in the other side, it's like, but dude, you're talking about dragons and fairies. I need proof. Show me a fairy wing. You can't just because I know it's true that, you know, that's like because I'm dad and I said so. Well, that's not an answer. I need to know more. I need deeper. Right. And that's what people want is that element of communication. Can we talk a little bit about the physical manifestations of seances and physical mediumship? There are, and I don't know, I apologize for not knowing enough about your backgrounds on this, but have you explored and gone to other physical mediums that claim to bring spirit forth? And have you witnessed those type of seances where the spirit is then walking around the room? What do you make of that?
That's a great question. So physical mediumship is quite rare to go and see it as far as like encountering it in a way that would feel safe for myself personally. Mm-hmm. And so we don't seek out as much of that as maybe we could if we felt a real need to do it. Because places like Lilydale aren't exclusively or explicitly doing it, and because the trend is more aligned towards mental mediumship, a lot of the information we have around physical developments in a spirit room in a seance are anecdotal or are testimonial. I personally, and Kat, I really do want your opinion on this, but I personally, this is not the Eckhart's or Kat's opinion, it's my own. Oh, I would have a hard time being present in that moment, in that space, to engage with a full floating apparition. I have seen one apparition in my life. I have seen one as clear as, you know, another human being sitting across the table from me. And it was profoundly personal, and it was directly involved with my relations. It was not someone else. I would have a hard time judging that fairly and honestly. And I know so many ways in which that could be, you know, done fraudulently, that I don't think my brain would accept it no matter what.
That's interesting. I love to explore. I love to witness and see what can be seen. So I don't think I'd worry about, you know, is this trickery or is this not? I just want to observe what it feels like to be in the space, what this is looking like, what other people are perceiving it as. So yeah, I have plans to go see physical mediums.
Yes, we would love to do it with more depth and more an awareness of, I would love to do it with the awareness of, we'll call them conditions, like test conditions. Even though I generally do not fall down that track of wanting to put everything into a measured container, where someone's telling me on demand they can produce a full floating face or ectoplasm or a full spirit, right, I would want incredible, incredible attention to detail and controls. But again, I think that's because I personally just would not be able to compute with that.
Does that then, that intention, sometimes shut down the experience of why Tim and Dave can stand next to each other at Waverly Hills and Dave can see a fully formed apparition and Tim cannot, because Tim has the belief he is a ghost repellent. Dave believes he is a ghost magnet. Will that intention negatively or positively impact the situation as well? If you're in there wanting, even though you said you don't like to compartmentalize or demand that kind of stringent proof, by wanting that, you know, expecting that, would that alter the experience altogether?
I think it would. Yeah. I think it would. There's a reason why people look towards physical mediumship with such heavy associations with fraud and with deception. And there is an element of cultural co-creation with that as well. I think when we look at items like the Ouija board, which historically are like a game and a date night activity, and how they've turned into the demonic portals to hell in every, you know, 13-year-old boy and girl's bedroom, we can see the way in which cultural influence co-creates and shapes the experiences people have on a paranormal level. So I think there's such an overwhelming sense of that in regards to specifically physical mediumship, that it may induce more instances even of that type of activity, of that type of experience with physical mediumship. However, I won't write it off. And as I said, we've had a strange encounter with that kind of thing, but it's not, oh, I just have such a hard time with it.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder if that's why Dan and I are so comfortable with mental mediumship and not physical mediumship, because we are not totally on board. We're kind of like, I don't know. I don't know if I want to try that because I don't know if it's really exists.
Or if it's useful. That's another good question.
Well, in these explorations, have you ever had a moment that pants filling moment of, oh shit, what have we got ourselves into?
Yes. Yes, 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 yes.
All right. Well, we need to hear it.
There were a few instances which I think I can point to, but I think the first really big one was in Baltimore. We were actually at, and you may be familiar with the space, we were at the Lord Baltimore Hotel. A mutual friend was there, and we were engaged in a seance, and it was the first moment where there was actual like movement of an object. A candle on the table had moved, visibly moved, not a foot, not, you know, dramatically thrown up against the wall, but it was that moment where you go, oh no, this is all very real, because it moved just a few inches. And you're saying, well, now this is outside of me. This isn't voices in my head. This isn't something that needs to be, like, you know, revisited in therapy. This is a externalized thing that's happened. And it broke my brain.
It's eerie in a way that mental mediumship is not as
eerie. It broke my brain. I tore that room apart. I tore that space apart looking for all the things that I know from the literature exist and have friends who are involved in like dramatic magical presentations and theater presentations. So I know that mindset to apply. And looked for like magnets in the table and all the goofy stuff. People are looking at me like, what is this man's problem?
Wow.
And then the only thing I was left with was on the drive home and late at night when I think about that candle moving. My part of my brain goes, I saw it. I saw it. I heard it. It happened. And the other part of me says, no, no, no. It was just a trick of the light. Now go to sleep.
Right. And that kind of becomes part of the problem for us, right? In these moments when sometimes I think that's why magic is held back. And I wonder if, you know, there's more real magic, real wonder and awe around us all the time. But because we're so, we put up so many perception filters for ourselves of what's acceptable and public, of why we don't see these things for the true magic that they are in the moment. Our brain goes to work. I saw UFOs in Trout Lake, Washington, and I've spent nights and, you know, probably months now, you know, when you add up all the hours I've spent thinking about this over the last 15 years, completely debating the subject of what I saw to myself. Mm-hmm. And instead of just accepting it for the wonder of what it was, this amazing moment, this holy shit right, second of time that I get to own and be a part of. And I've tried to do that more as I've strayed further and further away from different technology on paranormal investigations because I want to be there for the magic of the actual experience as opposed to the recorded element of it. Mm. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that we do put so much pressure on ourselves to decide what something is as we're experiencing it, which if you've had kind of a spiritual or paranormal experience, that's kind of ridiculous to ask of yourself because it is so uncanny. It is so odd. And I think that it would be easier for our experience of it. It would be easier to take more of it in and to live with ourselves afterwards if we just observed.
Exactly. There's always that element of people saying, well, if you see Bigfoot or you see a UFO or you see the haunted house, where is the proof? Why aren't you taking a photo? When Bigfoot comes out of the woods, why didn't you take a photo of it? You have a phone on your camera. And everyone, whether I
like that. You have a phone on your camera. That's
yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Exactly. And everybody who I've encountered with that says, you know, I don't know why I didn't. I have it right there. I know that. And I would say I would do it if I had the chance again. But it's such an encounter with the uncanny, with the weird. You can't behave in a normal way. You can't respond in a normal way.
And I love that people then turn that around and say, obviously, it was, you know, the Bigfoot was mentally stopping me from taking it. Or the spirit was, you know, keeping mm-hmm. me from doing that. No, it's the mm-hmm. human element of being present in that moment when you see mm-hmm. something extraordinary happen.
Yeah, exactly. Totally.
So does that mean that this field will forever live in a limbo, in a liminal space? I think maybe, but there's also something okay about that. I'm always very concerned when I hear people trying to pin down or say like, well, this definitive release of information on UFOs, which I guess is today, or this definitive ghost expose will be the one that proves or disproves and answers all our questions. I feel like that just sets us up for maybe missing the point of the paranormal, which is the big why question. Like, why the paranormal? Why spirits? Why ghosts? What are they here for? And what are we to do with that information? Like, is there an actual point?
Right.
I'd even want to know, to turn the question here, I'd really want to know from your perspective what the why is.
Be specific with the why of why are we looking, or why does it exist, or why are we not more aware of it? You know, if it's something that's really not supernatural at all, but part of the natural element.
if it's something that's supernatural or something that's natural, what does its existence have to teach us? What does it have to tell us about our experience?
You know, I think, isn't that interesting? We've been talking about the disclosure of UFOs and how mm-hmm. June is the month the government is going to give us a detailed account of what they know. And some of the experts, some of the people in the government said, we're going to release this. But you know what's going to happen? Those that want to see it as aliens from another planet are going to read that report that that's what we're saying. Those of that want to read this, that it is highly protected government information regarding our own technology, are going to read it that way. It's a subjective viewpoint to what you already come into it predisposed to believe. I think the problem with the supernatural is the fact that we are fearful of how we will read the information. Oh my God. You saw a ghost in a cemetery. Oh, shit. I'm stuck with a rotting corpse for the rest of eternity. Right? Yeah. That's how I see it. What you see is this amazing element of the soul surviving the physical form. My question, though, becomes why there? Right? My question is, why is there a child spirit? My God wouldn't leave a child behind. But mm-hmm. is that what the soul really is? Is it a child or is it a 300-year-old soul that's reincarnated five times? And it's really, you know, a much older spirit, but it's taking this most recent guise. It's I think people, because of that fear of the unknown, we're always asking and questioning, but we lend or we tend to lean into the fear side of it. So I think that's why people are less willing to always be accepting, because then that forces them to answer other questions that they might not want to deal with.
And that's the story of historically, the story of esotericism, the story of the occult, is these organizations and belief structures don't necessarily exist to be like, you know, nefarious organizations plotting the course of humanity. A lot of these organizations or these views or these beliefs that would be considered occult are explorations of just what you're saying, and a desire to be somewhat not above in a moral way, but outside of the question, to observe the multifaceted elements of it and make peace with just the observation. That, at least so far, has been my journey, and what I've seen most reflected is just that element of, okay, I am like the magician tarot card. I see all the elements on the table, or at least I hope to. And now I need to sit with, well, what does that imply? What does that imply about my existence and what I'm here to do?
Mm-hmm. Now, Kat, you never responded to, did you have a scary moment? And, you know, obviously everybody's a little disappointed with your husband because they wanted to say that he saw a flaming skull shoot across the room, not a candle from a few inches. What have you got for us?
Well, maybe the flaming skull is in our future.
That's right.
Let's hope that for opportunity. That.
Yeah. But what have you ever had an experience that left you frightened or you know?
Very much so.
All right. Yes. Can you explore that with us a little?
Of course. And you may enjoy this story as it is foundational to Dan and I's relationship. So before we started to do mediumship, before we started to do seances, before we knew anything about this kind of world, I went over to Dan's house when we were dating we had been dating for about a year?
Yeah.
Maybe less. And I went into his room and I turned around and I saw something in the doorway, and it was so shocking and so surprising to me because nothing seemed to preamble it. And I've never really seen anything before. I don't think I've seen anything in that way since. But there was a dark, shadowy, very tall figure. And I was horrified. I looked away and I looked back, and it wasn't there in the same way, but I could feel it. I could feel it there. And I freaked out. And Dan was like wondering what the heck was happening. At that point in time, I thought I just had an hallucination and a delusion. But I was left with such like an incredible fear. I trembled for an hour at least.
Yeah. And what Kat did not know is that I had been dealing with that for many years. Feelings of things in the room, nighttime visitations of scary stuff, which my only frame of reference was demons, which looking back probably made it worse. But it was this incredible moment of, oh my God, hey, I'm not alone as someone who's experienced this. And I thought I was, you know, maybe alone in that. Maybe I was just insane.
Maybe you were crazy.
But then you also had that visual sense of seeing.
Visual and I guess the knowing. But yeah, I haven't had such a scary experience since. And you spoke to the fear that kind of holds people back and shapes what they see. It took a long time to sort of get over the fear of seeing spirits before it became, well, experiencing. I still don't really see it in that way. But yeah, that was one of my first encounters.
Well, I know we don't have a whole lot of time left together, but I know one of the bullet points for our conversation today is the emerging science behind mediumship. What can you talk to us about that for people that are on the fence or still want more information or knowing if there's any legitimacy to these claims?
Absolutely. Well, there is a small body of research, smaller than I'd like, on mediumship and on psychic ability, but smaller on mediumship specifically. And there are organizations that are doing that research now, including the Institute, I believe, of Noetic Sciences, IONS, and the Winbridge Center had a really applauded study for their methodology on mediums a few years ago. So there is some research suggesting that mediums can attain information from some other source than the way that normal humans, I guess, the way that information is normally obtained. It's just that difficulty of understanding where exactly and pinpointing that. Is it psi? Is it connecting with a spirit? Or is it something that we don't even know? But there are some research studies that are interesting out of those two organizations.
There's a detection in different brain activity as well from like a neuroscience standpoint of like when mediumship is happening, the portions of the brain which would light up when someone was just like telling a story go kind of dim. So there's an interesting application around like what we're seeing. The problem is we don't really know how to fit all those things together. As Kat said, like just because the brain goes dark in this region when it should be bright, we think, doesn't mean necessarily we're contacting spirit. It just means something is happening.
I've always wondered about that with that view of the brain. If we took a musical genius like a Mozart and we strapped him in and read his brain as he was sitting at the piano composing at the moment, would we see a similar kind of signal? Because it's coming from an internal place as opposed to a thought-filled place or a place where over analytical.
And yeah, and you were speaking of Dr. Andrew Newberg's study on automatic writing, looking at experts, and we were talking about expertise as you were saying Mozart. He's an expert. Mm-hmm. So does it look different from people just sitting down and writing in their journal in general?
The failure of research, essentially. And one of the things that we really would love to see more.
The challenge of research.
We'll reframe that. The challenge of research is a lot of this because of the very aggressive swing against more esoteric or paranormal things as being fringe or fringe topics, the research, it's very difficult to do research on these. It's very difficult to get funding. And we would love to see more people explore what does it mean when we put, 100 mediums in a room and have spirit contact versus 100 people in a room looking at photos and telling us whether or not these people are still with us or not. Mm-hmm. I think that information will become more accessible over time. And the trends are encouraging because more research is now being done. There's not such a aggressive stigma, although there still is a hesitancy to use terms like mediumship in the actual research.
Absolutely.
Fascinating stuff. Guys, what I'd love to do is have you back sometime where we can delve into different aspects of your own paranormal investigations and your thoughts on that. I know our time here in 90 minutes flew by for me, and it's been a pleasure chatting with you guys, but I'd love to have you come on, and maybe we could even do it on a Thursday night live chat so that audience members can participate with you and some of this. But in leaving us with the concepts of seance, mediumship, communication with the other world, where do you come down, each one of you, where do you come down on it? Do you believe that we are speaking to disincarnate souls? Are we speaking to a greater consciousness like the Akashic records? Are we speaking to our own perceptions of what we believe things are? Where do you guys come down on this? Or do you have totally different ideas than that?
Gosh, I'm looking at Dan because I'm not even sure if we have the exact same idea.
I don't think we do.
Okay, I'll allow you to have different ideas today.
Yes.
The theory I think is most accurate to my experience is the first one you mentioned, the speaking to discarnate spirits. But I also believe in perhaps the blending of those other eschatologies. And I have to keep an open mind because I don't want to shut myself off from further evidence, from further understanding of how the world works and how this works. What do you think, Dan?
I think that there is some core of consciousness that we're connecting to.
Yeah.
And whether that consciousness, whether this is psi, and that consciousness is a lived memory that someone sitting across the table or in the audience or in the haunted location has of their departed loved one that we're picking up on through psi and giving body and ritual energy to. Or whether it is actually a, you know, discarnate soul that has moved on and is in some other form of consciousness. I struggle between those two. And I wonder if the distinction truly matters in the end. There's always, in my mind, this kind of comfort to the idea that if you hear knocking in the woods, it's Bigfoot. If you hear knocking in your house, it's a ghost. I wonder if the same is true for spirit contact. Are we tapping into greater consciousness and giving it the lens of spirit because that's what we expect and that's how that information manifests? Or is it actually some discarnate entity? Either are fine. For me, it's the experience of it and creating that kind of interaction, creating the possibility of it.
I like the idea, like you stated, that, you know, does it matter? I think where it does for people is because the grand scale of it is the death is the final frontier. Mm. We want to know what comes next. We want to know what we can expect. And are we, you know, if it's just that we're tapping into a kind of conscious library like the Akashic records, that doesn't necessarily say the soul continues on, but the memories of those souls do. Is there life in that, right? I mean, where does life truly lie then? Where is consciousness? But then if we're looking at the concept of disincarnate souls, why do some elect to stay here? Are they stuck? Are they fractures of who we are, these elements of who we are? Could the reason we see grandma's little girl ghost in her childhood home was because we don't know that there was an element of abuse or trauma that fractured a piece of her at that time, and that will always remain there? And then yet we see her as a 30-year-old at the hair salon she used to work at because she loved it. Was there elements of who we are that exist everywhere we've been because there's a piece of us that we leave behind in those situations?
Right. And those are the questions that drive us.
Yeah, that's really what this work is about, I think, for you, for us, is exploration and really hoping to find real closure around that. But being, at least as of yet for myself, being unable to to firmly sit in one of those camps?
I hope I never firmly sit.
Okay.
Because then, I mean, I'm open to all these experiences, all these different inputs.
Exactly.
That's a great point, right? By once you become too complicit to an ideal,
yeah,
you become a slave to it. And
yes,
that's the magic. You know, people have said, how can you still be afraid of death? And I've said, because I think once I firmly accept that death is just what it is, the excitement of exploring beyond it is gone. Mm-hmm. That means I've got an answer. Yeah. And although my fear of death is mostly gone now after my experience with a journey a little over a year ago, I still, you know, there's still that pang of the unknown, not necessarily of death itself, but of what comes next. That's the element that's still a little bit frightening, I think, for all of us. Mm-hmm. And if we got that answer, I think it's a dangerous element. There's reasons, like you said, why spirits let us know things in certain ways, why these fears, you know, because I've been depressive and anxiety filled and suicidal in different points in my life. Maybe that is a survival mechanism, my fear of death. Right? Because it's like, hey, jackass, don't do this. You don't know what comes next, right? It's your ego and id trying to save you from yourself.
Yes.
So, you know, is that what the consciousness of the soul is? Guys, I'd love to talk more with you. We've got to connect on here, and I hope that I'll be able to see you guys out at some conferences and things as the year progresses and the world opens up and we're back out there again. But thank you both for coming on and joining us today and sharing your insights and perspectives on this.
Well, thank you for having us.
This was lovely.
Yeah, this was a great time.
Well, that's it for today, folks. Again, we do have our show tomorrow. It'll be a special presentation podcast, A Dark and Stormy Night. Make sure you tune in and check that out. Come on out and visit with Tim and I. If you guys are in the Pennsylvania or surrounding area and you'd like to come on out and meet with us and have a great time meeting fantastic people with like minds and interested in the elements that we talk about on the show, Phenom 2020 is the way to go. Phenom2020.com. That's Phenom 2020.com. Go check it out. Make sure you also take advantage of the offers that our advertisers offer during our program, because they are great. They see the concept of what we do. They see the importance of what they do, and they want to support us. So you can help us by supporting them. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio.